They were taken by Peter Fortune, an INS agent in Hawaii, called up to Fort Missoula, where he worked in food service and in his free time took photographs. In one of the photographs, Midori is wearing a bra and white slip, skin-toned stockings rolled down his thighs, and black shoes, and is posing alone, smiling. Midori's body and face are a map describing a territory I know, think I know, or have known, but which looks from the vantage of this graphic projection of him unfamiliar, another territory altogether. I try to locate myself. Every landmark and place name, every feature is visible, if not accessible, at once. But the cardinal directions have switched places, gone missing. I've always associated hair that stands straight up off a person's head as evidence of the restlessness of their thoughts. Midori's ears are large. When I squint, his ears move. His right leg is up on a wooden bench. His right hand is cupping his knee. His left leg is bent. The back of his left hand, pressed against his hip, covered by the waistline of the slip hanging mid-thigh, evokes restraint. Two veins run the length of his left forearm. The vein in his right arm, corresponding to the vein on the underside of his left, is visible, originating in the terminal of his elbow, snaking to his wrist. That is where I see myself most clearly, in his veins and arms, his right arm straight, partially obscured at his bicep by his bra and chest. His left pectoral visible between his shoulder and the top of the bra. Two eels are swimming beneath his skin. His stockings are rolled down his thighs just below the hem of the slip. The slip is tight, though soft. The waistline of his slip is folded in above his navel. The hem of his slip is a fringe of wide circles. Around each circle is a wider circle. A black line beginning at the top of his right thigh swoops at his crotch. The line tapers, disappears into whiteness. Midori's eyes are clear, almost wet with the flash of the bulb, twice reflected. His eyebrows are slightly raised. It is there that I begin to sense skepticism, concern, distrust, and its corresponding lack of agency, resignation. Two lines on his forehead form a pediment. He is smiling, but the lines around his eyes are unmoved. His upper lip is straight, unconvinced. Sometimes his smile is a wave, sometimes a wound. Sometimes not entirely his. If not, to whom and how many people, entities, institutions does it belong? Midori did not know Peter Fortune, nor did he know who would see this photograph. He posed in several dimensions at once. Half naked, proud, even triumphant, he is, against a wall of thick timber, performing. But the longer I stare at his body and face, his eyes and his smile, the less convinced I become that he is actually sharing or free to share any part of himself. Who he is and what he is feeling is being sublimated, suppressed by his outward appearance, pushed down the deep well of his throat, into his chest, but beyond the reach of his heart. When I left the museum, the barracks, the fields, I felt infused with the spirit of connection. Midori and I had been reunited, but the feeling did not last. There was no sense that Midori had been waiting for me, his grandson, anyone. Almost as soon as the body and face of incarceration were revealed, they were replaced with an unconquerable loneliness. The sky was low and tyrannically white. The mountains in the distance were suddenly very close, cliff-like and impenetrable. I called my grandmother, then my father. Their voices were soft, underwater. It was not that they did not seem interested in the photographs, but they did not ask any questions, which caused me to doubt what I had seen. It was true. The barracks, isolated and staged, manifested an alternate universe, one in which my desperation had been appeased. I had reduced the history of incarceration not only to Midori's face, but to my desire to understand.
We've been listening to Brandon Shimoda read from his latest book, The Grave on the Wall. So when we think about this photo, maybe like the picture bride photos, but where you're having an encounter that at first might seem to capture a moment, and then the more you stare at it, the more under inspection it seems to be suggesting something beneath the surface that maybe even contradicts the surface. I think about the other photos that you gravitate toward in other books of yours, which also seem to have this quality. So the cover of your previous book, The Desert, has the three figures in festive ritual clothing and decorative masks. And you might just look at this without any context and see a celebration. And it is technically a celebration. It's a celebration of the Harvest Festival, but from inside the Thule Lake concentration camp during World War II, which interned thousands of Japanese and Japanese Americans. And this same photographer, Francis Stewart, took other photos that, like the picture of your grandfather in women's clothes, seem hard to parse. And most notably, the photos of incarcerated Japanese Americans in blackface or dressed as Native Americans. And you write about your encounter with these photos in your essay, I Am an American, The Photographic Legacy of Japanese American Incarceration. And in that you say, the appearance of a young Nikkei couple in blackface in a U.S. concentration camp on land that had until the late 1800s been inhabited for thousands of years by the Modoc people articulates the dynamic in which non-white people, native, alien, slave, are manipulated as the subjects and counter-subjects of a chronic performance. The photograph illuminates a nearly subliminal moment of anti-blackness masquerading as minstrelsy, masquerading as carefree, careless, communal play-acting, masquerading as jubilation under duress, aka mass oppression. I guess I was hoping you'd speak more about chronic performance, mm-hmm. not just in relationship to these photographs, but I guess gesturing towards the chronic performance of America. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I guess, when I think of photography, for a lot of people, their first response is one that they're getting neutral documentation, mm-hmm. that they're getting objective reporting, that they're getting the moment is being captured.
Right. Do people still feel that way?
Well, I don't think people who are writing about it,
right.
about photography,
yeah.
think that way.
Right.
But I would think like an average person who right. hasn't investigated it might have a more of a bias towards that with a yeah. photograph than with a painting.
Yeah. One of the first things you said was being able to move beyond the surface of what is seen, right? So looking at a photograph and being able to move beyond or through the surface of something. But I'm not even sure people are paying attention to the surface of things, right? So I would actually correct something I wrote in that piece in which I describe this photograph, as you described, of two young Japanese American couple in blackface. So I wrote in that piece, it's a nearly subliminal moment of anti-blackness, but it's not nearly or subliminal at all. I mean, it's very much on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw that photograph in an exhibition in a museum in Tucson that had many photographs, the original WPA photographs of the camps. And then a photographer took those photographs, found the people in all those subjects, and went and photographed them now. And they're all in their 70s and 80s.
Hmm.
But within that exhibition is this blackface photograph. And it's, in terms of its surface, that's what it is. You don't have to really go beyond the surface in order to see what that is. So I'm questioning as to why I said it was subliminal. I think it's subliminal, and things are subliminal because of the viewer. And the viewer, the way they're engaging with what's there, is in a way preordained. So I think that every time there's an exhibition of photographs about Japanese American incarceration, the response is in a sense preordained. You know, as I was in this particular exhibition, I was listening, I was eavesdropping on conversations that other people were having as they were looking at the photographs. And it's the kind of language that I remember hearing from my family when I was younger about, oh, it's such a shame, and can you believe what they did? You know, all these kinds of things that don't really mean anything. And then there's a photograph of two people in blackface and it's receiving no comment whatsoever because it doesn't fit into people's form of remembrance and memorialization.
So is that similar to the lack of a caption for your grandfather's photo? Like there's a way in which, because it doesn't settle into that,
yeah,
that you sort of skip over
right,
commenting on it.
It defies captioning.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's the photograph that to me revealed something, a more explicit truth, a more buried, a more in shadowed, but more maybe honest and accurate and more debilitating truth of what that history was all about, you know, in terms of this kind of like the psychosis of colonization. And thinking about chronic performance, it's like thinking about the ways in which oppressed communities and populations are forced to cannibalize each other or dismember each other at the service of some dominant power, right?
That's where I wondered whether, I mean, I agree with you that it's on one level all on the surface. The anti-blackness is on the surface, but then there's the subtext of not understanding who's anti-blackness.
Right.
So, I mean, your first glance could be, oh, it's Japanese or Japanese American anti-blackness, which it may or may not be, but is it really? And can people who are incarcerated really be making free choices? And under what circumstances are they making these specific choices?
Right.
And to what ends and what compromises? Like all of that's the part that doesn't feel like it's on the surface.
Oh yeah.
Though maybe right. It is on the surface.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I was just thinking about how people weren't even people. Well, I can't speak for people who are looking or not looking at anything, but I imagine that it presented something so inherently uncomfortable that they couldn't even see the surface to even get to some of those considerations.
Yeah,
right?
That makes sense to me.
That it was, I guess that's what I mean. It becomes subliminal because the viewer has this certain block. Hmm. But right, I mean, what it unfolds, once you actually are confronting and addressing this thing, it starts to unfold pretty rapidly. It's like this accordion book that opens out and uncovers all the story behind, the many stories behind the story that's being promoted. So I'm referencing this one exhibition in Tucson, but also the exhibition in Missoula. And I do feel like against the will and the whims of the people who are putting these kinds of exhibitions together, against that is the will, the even more overpowering will of the material, that the material will begin to leak through the surface that is proposed by the maker, by the curators, etc. It will leak and it will, it's indomitable. It will start to assert its own force, and some fragments of a truth will begin to congeal. But obviously there's, you know, the viewer has a responsibility to be attentive to that.
And when you say the material exerts its own force, that's also, I'm imagining, independent of the photographer who made the material.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. 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 I mean, ideally, I mean, that photographer was commissioned by the government, like Dorothea Lange and Frances Stewart. They were commissioned by the government, so they had an obligation to do a certain kind of work. But I imagine that even those photographers knew that they were going to be capturing things that defied their commission. And it's the same with being a writer or any kind of artist. I at least hope that I'm producing things that are, I hope that I'm producing things that are defying even my wishes. You know, I can't control whether or not that's good or bad, but I think that, like, maybe a more honest reality will emerge from what I've made. I mean, that there's a limit to what, to like my agency in relation to what I'm producing, I think.
Mm-hmm. One book that I thought a lot about in relationship to this book, which I know you reviewed a long time ago, but also an artist who you've been in correspondence with, is Banu Kapil's Humanimal. And in that book, where she's returning to India, where her ancestors are from, to investigate this story of girls in the 1920s who were purportedly raised by wolves and then rescued by a reverend and rehabilitated, a lot of that feels like she's having to put herself in the position of having limited documentation, mm-hmm. and not being able to parse what she does have, similar to this photograph. So she goes, and she, all of the documentation she has, or most of it, is from the reverend himself, and is also sort of a self-serving performance that he does for profit at mm-hmm. the expense of the girls. And she has a French film crew with her, and that French film crew themselves hire a folkloric acting troupe to reenact the girls being raised by wolves. And so there's just sort of a Russian doll setup of various attempts at representation and documentation mm-hmm. that none of which are claiming anything absolute. And you can tell that she doesn't even think that's possible in this sense. Mm-hmm. But it almost feels like her father, which she inserts into the story as a body, is the book. And mm-hmm. and you wrote in this, in your review, something interesting to me. Banu's family emerges in the form of her father, memories of his skin, the skin on his feet, a map back, but to where, the body at once and in an instant, a sight, a wound, an unraveling atlas. And you had mentioned when you, in that reading you just did, this idea of a map with your own grandfather. And I think about the way she's using literally the flesh of her father, the scars on his body, and what do those represent when she's looking at this story of colonial violence in India, mm-hmm. and perhaps why she didn't end up, the story of why she ended up growing up in England, and, mm-hmm. which I would imagine also the question of like, why is your family in Hawaii and then California and, mm-hmm. and now here? So I was hoping maybe you could speak to this question of the body, mm-hmm. And to the missing body of your grandfather. Because in another piece you say, in the Poetry Foundation, you wrote, the first corpse I did not see was my grandfather's. His corpse is why I am here, poetry. Mm-hmm. Intuitively, I feel like there's a move that you're both making that is a kindred move, mm-hmm. and it has something to do with bodies.
I knew that when I began to take seriously the fact and the bitter responsibility of being a citizen of the United States, that I would have to confront my ancestors' struggle to become citizens of the United States. And in particular, my grandfather's struggle. And I knew that in order to understand my uncontested situation, I would have to really interrogate what he endured and how the United States and both the impossibility of becoming a citizen and then the potential of becoming a citizen in a way shaped his relationship to himself, and that he had to disfigure himself and transform himself into a certain type of legible body. It was in large part through my grandfather's experience, as well as other of my ancestors who immigrated from Japan, that I was able to understand what this country even is. So in a way that hopefully it wasn't too violent as his grandson, I sort of used his body and his life as this map that, you know, extended from Hiroshima to Death Valley. And that I really needed him, and from his experience to his skin, to be able to really understand what is this country about, and what is my relationship to the history of this place, both personally and communally and nationally. So maybe there's some correspondence there with Humanimal, or what you described of humanimal.
Well, is there a correspondence there with what you've just said with your own words? His corpse is why I am here, poetry.
Yeah, well, that feels even more personal. So he died in 1996, and I was 18, but he had Alzheimer's for, we'll say, 15 years. It's hard to chart exactly, which means that he had it since I was age 3. So my entire relationship with him was a relationship with a disintegrating being, a person who was in a constant state of decline, a person who was in a constant state of degeneration. I was not there when he died. I did not go to his funeral. I wasn't even there when he was dying, so I didn't see him the last 5 years of his life. This is just a speculation, but I feel like not even that a lot of what I write is about him, but that I write at all is at least in part related to the fact that I was not a participant in his dying and his death. Because my very earliest writings, including the first thing I ever published, were stories about him. Were stories of trying to recuperate even just my sense of who this person was, who had an enormous impact on me, who was someone I was very close with despite his disintegrative state. Maybe it was intuitive, maybe it was unconscious, but I felt like I wanted to reanimate him because there was something about him and his life that would teach me something about mine. Myself and my life. That's the unconscious part. But he was a figure that I felt like, he was a figure that almost instantaneously populated my writing. So when I think about his was the first corpse I did not see, that's basically a way of saying he was my first loss. You know, he was my first and maybe most primary loss. And that out of that loss generated this entire imaginative space, this inner life that has now become an outer life. And that over time, what it revealed was my relationship to the country in which I live.
Hmm. Well, I want to connect these thoughts to an ongoing interest of yours of memorials and memorialization, which we see throughout your work, books and otherwise. First, I'm just going to read a quote that I connect to this interest of yours. I don't think you're necessarily connecting it, but I'm going to make a potential one where you said, "The occasion of poetry has makes possible the dehumanization of the body through predatory grieving, the loss of one's own body, the loss of another's body, the loss of all bodies. Because if a corpse is not real, neither is the living body." So when I think about this, about the question of the corpse being real and how that reflects back on the people who are alive in relationship to it, and I think about, again, your investigation of memorialization and memorials. We can look at In the Grave on the Wall, you go looking for the cemetery of your ancestors in a town that no longer exists in Japan. You go to the commemorations of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You go to the African burial ground in Manhattan. And in other writings, you visit the memorial stupa in the killing fields of Cambodia. And you write about the Japanese internment memorial here in Portland, Oregon. And you have a quote in one of your essays that says, "If you don't know anything about the history of a place, the rise and genocidal history of a place that is that place, if you don't know anything about the people who were killed and the people who did the killing and the people who neither killed nor did the killing but did the killing, if you don't know anything about the history that is the present moment and vice versa and the next and the bodies underneath your feet and the bodies in the air you're breathing, that is America." And when I think of that quote, which is amazing, I would initially imagine that you'd be happy about the existence of memorials, that they would be this gesture, this counter gesture against the forgetting, this acknowledgement of history and of place, and in place, typically, not always, but often in specific places. But it feels like when we visit these memorials and commemorations with you, the predominant one is a feeling of something being hidden or avoided or prematurely closed off through the process of memorialization. Uh-huh. And so much so that when I'm with you in these different visits, the things that I still remember are not as so much the memorials, but the guy in the blue jacket with the leaf blower and someone mowing the lawn near one of the statues, or the police sweeping out the homeless of the Portland Japanese Memorial. So I was hoping, in a larger sense, you could talk about why you feel like you return to this question of memorialization and memorials, and also and particularly why you feel attracted to go to them when it does feel like there's a dissatisfaction that happens over and over in the encounter with them.
Yeah. Yeah, your questions are great. really disarming. Mm. I am happy when I go to memorials.
You are?
Yeah. I'm also sad and angry and disappointed. I'm also inevitably distracted. But what I've determined is that the thing I'm distracted by is actually the memorial. I go to a memorial thinking, for example, this is a memorial for the hundreds of thousands of people who died in the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. But what happens when you get to a memorial is you, because it's in the present and because life is unfolding as it does, you start to pay attention to things that are happening in that moment. And to me, the things that are happening in that moment are the true consciousness of that memorial. Or at least the manifestation of the memorial. And I'm happy about going and being surprised and being and being shook out of my preconceived ideas of what it is that we're commemorating, right? The thing that frustrates me about memorials in general is the fact that they're attempting to articulate a history that, for the most part, has not ended. I don't think there's a single memorial I've been to that is addressing a history that's actually over, you know? And I think no memorial really addresses that fully. A question that has been really motivating for me in the past couple years is a question posed by Christina Sharp in her book In the Wake on Blackness and Being. And it is, how do we memorialize an event that is still ongoing? That's a huge question. It seems like a simple question, but it's a huge question. And I wonder how memorials themselves might answer that question. Because in my opinion, it seems like most of the events that are being memorialized, at least in the memorials that I've visited that I'm drawn to, most of those events are still ongoing. They might be ongoing in a different form, in maybe a less legible form, maybe in an even more legible form, more explicit form. But it makes me wonder, what is it exactly when we go to a memorial that we're memorializing, that we're remembering?
Thanks for being on the show today, Brandon.
Thank you, David. It's been really wonderful.
We are talking today to Brandon Shimoda, the author of The Grave on the Wall. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. We'll be right back.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.